Chapter number 70, Socialism, page number 852. Definition. Socialism as an alternative to capitalism has the widest appeal. A Swedish king once remarked to his minister, "If one is not a socialist up to the age of 25, it shows that he has no heart. But if he continues to be a socialist after the age of 25, he has no head." Socialism seems to have caught the imagination of youth all over the world. For a long time, the definition of socialism as given by the Webbs was accepted by a majority of the socialists. Their definition runs thus. A socialized industry is one in which the national instruments of production are owned by public authority or voluntary association and operated not with a view to profiting by sale to other people, but for the direct service of those whom the authority or voluntary association represents. This definition does not correspond to the present notion of socialism because it does not imply any idea of planning. The definition given by H.D. Dickinson seems to be better. According to him, socialism is an economic organization of society in which the material means of production are owned by the whole community and operated by the organs representative of and responsible to the community according to general plan, all members of the community being entitled to benefits from the results of such socialized planned production on the basis of equal rights. According to another definition, which brings out the implications of socialism more clearly, socialism refers to that movement which aims at vesting in society as a whole rather than in individuals, ownership and management of all nature-made and man-made producers' goods used in large-scale production to the end that an increased national income may be more equally distributed without materially destroying the individual's economic motivation or his freedom of occupational and consumption choices. In Morrison's words, the important essentials of socialism are that all the great industries and the land should be publicly or collectively owned and that they should be conducted in conformity with a national economic plan for the common good instead of private profit. Page number 853. There is no complete agreement as to what socialism exactly is. It seems there are as many types of socialism as there are socialists. Socialism has been compared to a hat which has lost its shape because everybody wears it. It has been aptly remarked that socialism has been called many things and many things have been called socialism. The kaleidoscopic nature of socialism has been described by Shadwell thus. It is both abstract and concrete, theoretical and practical, idealist and materialist, very old and entirely modern. It ranges from a mere sentiment to a precise program of acting. Different advocates present it as a philosophy of life, a sort of religion, an ethical code, an economic system, a historical category, a judicial principle. It is a popular movement and scientific analysis, an interpretation of the past and a vision of the future, a war cry and the negation of war, a violent revolution and a gentle revolution, a gospel of love and altruism, and a campaign of hate and greed, the hope of mankind and the end of civilization, the dawn of the millennium and a frightful catastrophe. How paradoxical! From the definitions given above, we are in a position to understand the basic idea or ideas underlying socialism. In simple words, socialism implies a social ownership of means of production. But besides social ownership of instruments of production, socialism implies several other things. It implies equality of incomes and equality of opportunity for all. Socialism does not mean that all productive resources should be owned by the state. Only the major instruments of production should be under the state control so that the economy is run for social benefit rather than private profit. Socialism wants to change the old capitalistic structure of society and replace it by a new economic order based on equality and social justice. Instead of social prerogatives and vested interests, socialism lays emphasis on work and ability and equal opportunities for all, regardless of caste, class, and inherited privileges. Authoritarian socialism versus liberal socialism. It may be instructive to distinguish between two types of socialism: A. Authoritarian socialism and B. Liberal socialism. In authoritarian socialism, state ownership covers all the means of production and allocates them by planning for the production of various goods. In this system, there is no sovereignty of the consumer nor any freedom for the labor to organize themselves. What to produce, how to produce, and how is output to be distributed, how much is to be invested for economic development, all these decisions are made by the government. This authoritarian socialism is generally called communism, which is prevalent in countries like Russia and China. On the other hand, under liberal socialism, the government takes up the ownership of the means of production, but the price system or market mechanism is retained. The consumers are given the choice of consumption. The managers of factories appointed by the government produce commodities considering the consumer's demands and the prices of the factors supplied by the government. The concept of liberal socialism has been propounded by economists like Dickinson, Lange and Taylor. Marxian socialism. Karl Marx, who wrote in 1867 his famous book Das Kapital, the Bible of Socialism, is considered to be the father of scientific socialism. He tried to put the theory of socialism on a scientific basis. This theory led him to the conclusion that capitalism was doomed to decay. Main elements of Marxian theory. The chief points of the Marxian theory are discussed below. 1. Materialistic conception of history. Karl Marx seeks to explain every event of history on economic ground. He gives an economic interpretation of history. All wars, riots, and political movements have their origin in economic factors. There is an appropriate political organization corresponding to every economic stage. A capitalist economy, for example, will evolve a system of government which perpetuates and supports property rights. He goes on to explain how capitalism will generate conditions which will replace it by socialism. The capitalist will grow in wealth as time passes but will become fewer and fewer, the bigger wheels swallowing the smaller ones. Monopolies will be created. Production will expand, necessitating scramble for markets abroad. This will lead to an imperialist war, and one war will be followed by another more terrible than the preceding one till capitalism perishes in the conflict and the dictatorship of the proletariat is established. Page number 854. 2. Labor theory of value. According to Karl Marx, value represents the human labor used in production. In other words, the value of a commodity depends on the labor used in the production of that commodity. It is equal to the socially necessary labor time. Marx defined value of a commodity as the labor time required to produce an article under the normal conditions of production and with an average degree of skill and intensity prevalent at the time. Karl Marx has given the same definition of capital as Ricardo has defined it on the basis of past labor. As for differences in quality of labor, he considered efficient labor as a form of intense labor. According to him, a given quantity of skilled labor is equal to a bigger amount of ordinary labor. He said, this deficiency is continuously being made good. Whatever may be the amount of skilled labor used in the production of a commodity, but if it is equated to a commodity produced by ordinary labor, its price will represent only a given quantity of ordinary labor. According to Marx, the ratio of skilled labor and unskilled labor is fixed by convention. In his view, skilled labor is more valuable because, as compared with unskilled labor, it requires more time and labor. 3. Theory of surplus value and exploitation. Marx propounded his theory of surplus value on the basis of his theory of value. He said that in order to enable labor to carry on the work of production, he should have some instruments of production and the other facilities, but he lacks these facilities. Hence, he has to sell his labor to the capitalist. It is, however, not necessary for the capitalist to pay labor the full value of the product produced by him. Here, Karl Marx supported his theory on the basis of classical theory, that is, the subsistence theory of value, according to which the level of wages is determined by the subsistence of the worker. What happens is that a worker continues working even after he has earned a sufficient amount of money for his subsistence. That is, he continues working even beyond the time when he has put in labor worth its price. Sometimes he works for 12 hours, whereas 6 hours labor was enough to compensate the capitalist. Thus, work of labor force is not merely to produce value equal to its price, but much more. This surplus value is the difference between the market value of the commodity and the cost of the factors used in the production of the commodity. Karl Marx says that the manufacturer gets for his commodity more than what he has spent on labor and other costs. The excess of market value over the cost is the surplus value. By using this surplus value, the capitalist can get still more surplus. This surplus is the creation of labor. It is created because labor is paid much less than is due to it. He characterized the appropriation of the surplus value by the capitalist as a robbery and exploitation. A commodity, according to him, is simply crystallized labor or congealed labor. In this way, the capitalist class goes on becoming richer and richer through exploitation of the working class. Thus, Karl Marx propounded his theory of exploitation on the basis of the theory of surplus value. 4. Capitalist development and its end. According to Karl Marx, the forces that operate in the capitalistic system lead to greater and greater exploitation of labor. The capitalists compete against one another to increase their profits. Like Ricardo, Karl Marx has asserted that in the long run, wages have a tendency to fall to the minimum subsistence level. In other words, according to Marx, excepting in the short run, wages do not exceed the subsistence level. But the reason put forward by Marx for the wage being equal to subsistence level are different from those given by Ricardo. According to Ricardo, wages keep to the subsistence level owing to increase in population. But according to Marx, it is the excess of current supply of labor over demand that prevents the wages from rising above the subsistence level. Since the supply of labor continues to be in excess of the demand for it, there is always in existence a large supply of labor which Marx calls the reserve army of labor. Hence, it is this large reserve army of labor, that is, mass of unemployed labor, which prevents wages from rising above the subsistence level. Page number 855. The supply of labor exceeds the demand for it because the capitalist entrepreneurs are unable to absorb All the labor rendered jobless by the destruction of handicrafts, or when the per-capitalist entrepreneur, when the pre-capitalist entrepreneurs are displaced by the capitalist entrepreneurs owing to lower per capita productivity in the pre-capitalist period. So long as the capitalist entrepreneur flourishes at the expense of the pre-capitalist entrepreneur, the supply of wage earners exceeds the demand for them. Owing to wage continuing at the subsistence level, the techniques of production which increase productivity also increase the rate of exploitation. In this way, the profits of the capitalists go up. According to Marx, the capitalists who are owners of the physical means of production compete against one another so that they may be able to raise the rate of exploitation and thus maximize their profits. That is why Professor Patterson has said that in the Marxian theory, competition among the owners of physical means of production for increasing the rate of exploitation or the non-wage share takes the form of a conflict or struggle. There are three ways of increasing the rate of exploitation or the surplus value. A. To increase the rate of exploitation by increasing the length of the working day. When the working hours are increased, total output increases, but wages being fixed, the rate of exploitation increases, or the profits extracted by the capitalists increase. B. Surplus value, or the rate of exploitation, is increased by the more intensive use of labor. The working hours are not increased, but the workers are made to produce more. But the surplus value cannot be substantially increased by these two methods. C. According to Marx, there is a third and more important method of increasing surplus value, that is, to increase the physical productivity of labor by technological progress. Technical progress implies improvements in techniques of production by which labor is able to produce more, working the same number of hours as before, or working with the same intensity as before. The result is that the total output of labor increases. C. According to Marx, there is a third and more important method of increasing surplus value, that is, to increase the physical productivity of labor by technological progress. Technical progress implies improvements in techniques of production by which labor is able to produce more, working the same number of hours as before, or working with the same intensity as before. The result is that the total output of labor increases. Since wages continue at the subsistence level, the margin between the subsistence output and the improved technique output widens. In this way, there is increase in surplus value or the rate of exploitation. But technical progress can be achieved only through the accumulation of capital. The result is that there is keen competition among the capitalists to accumulate capital. But in the Marxian system, as Kaldor says, the accumulation of capital is done not for the lure of profit, but it is thrust on the capitalists by the competitive struggle among them. Thus, discussing the hidden motives of capital formation, Kaldor observed that Ricardo explained it as arising from the desire for higher rate of profit. The capitalists of their own desire accumulate capital so long as the rate of profit from the productive use of capital is more than the minimum required for risk-taking. For Marx, capital accumulation by capitalist entrepreneurs is not a matter of their own choosing, but a matter of necessity. This is due to a keen competition among the capitalists themselves. This has been explained with the help of economies of scale. There is an implicit assumption that capital used by a particular capitalist is governed by his own accumulation. Considering the fact that larger the scale of operation, the more efficient will be his production. Every producer automatically led to an increase in his scale of output by the reinvestment of his profits. He does so because he does not want to lag behind in the competitive race. Thus, we see that owing to technical progress and stepping up of capital accumulation, as capitalism develops, the rate of exploitation or surplus value of labor increases on account of competitive struggle among the capitalists. Consequently, as capitalism develops, the national income will rise, but the relative share of wages, that is, share of labor, will fall. And the relative share of profit or the share of the capitalist will go up. Thus, the working of capitalistic system results in the worsening condition of the working class. Marx has called it the law of increasing misery of the working class. According to this law, owing to technical progress, increase in capital accumulation and the consequent increase in national income, under capitalism, the relative share of wages in national income is bound to fall, and that of capital is bound to go up. Page number 856. It is thus clear that the conclusion at which Marx arrives regarding the changes in the relative shares in the national income owing to the development of capitalism is contrary to that of Ricardo. Ricardo thought with the development of capitalistic economy, the relative share of wages in the national income would rise, whereas the share of profits would decline. Professor Patterson has rightly remarked that in the Marxian model of income distribution, the fundamental reason of the decline in the relative share of wages is technical progress, the full benefits of which go to the owners of physical means of production. The increasing hardship of the working class is not due to the declining level of real wages because, in absolute terms, their hardship is not aggravated. The reason is that there may not be any increase in real wages along. The reason is that there may not be any increase in real wages along with increase in productivity. Yet, there is no decline either. This is the essence of Marxian theory of distribution. Although Marx came to the conclusion that on the development of capitalism, the relative share of profits will increase owing to technical progress and the accumulation of capital, but following Ricardo, he too accepted the view that owing to the accumulation of capital, the rate of profit would decline. It may be specially noted that according to Marx, on the development of capitalistic economy, when the relative share of profits goes up, there is a fall in the rate of profit. It looks paradoxical, but Marx fully explained the coexistence of these two trends, that is, the share of profit and the rate of profit. But Marx did not explain the declining rate of profit with the help of the law of diminishing returns, which Ricardo had emphasized. Instead, Marx explained the declining rate of profits on the basis of an increase in the organic composition of capital. Surplus value is basic for profits and accumulation. The aim of the capitalist is to increase surplus value to the maximum. At first, when the supply of labor is large, wage rate remains constant at the subsistence level, but sooner or later, the demand for labor exceeds the available supply and wages rise, reducing thereby surplus value. With the loss of surplus value, there is a crisis, as the capitalist has no incentive to invest. He also tries to create again a surplus of labor by using labor-saving machinery, but this also is a temporary solution, as a too frequent resort to this device will lower the rate of profit and thereby reduce the capitalist's incentive to accumulate. Thus, capitalism is doomed to fail and give place to socialism. This is the picture which Marx himself gives of the end of capitalism. Along with the constantly diminishing number of the magnates of capital who usurp and monopolize all advantages of this process of transformation, grows the mass of misery, oppression, slavery, degradation, exploitation. But with this too grows the revolt of the working class, a class always increasing in numbers and disciplined, united, organized by the very mechanism of the process of capitalist production itself. Centralization of the means of production and socialization of labor at last reach a point where they become incompatible with their capitalist integument. This integument bursts asunder. The knell of capitalist private property sounds. The expropriators are expropriated. Criticism of Marxian theory. Marx has proved to be a poor prophet of future events. Some of the predictions of Marx have proved to be true, while others have proved to be wrong. His prediction regarding the increasing hold of monopoly has been proved to be true by later events. But his other prediction regarding continuous misery for the working class under capitalism has proved to be wrong in countries where capitalism has been successful. In countries of Western Europe and the USA, the standard of living of the worker has been steadily rising and not falling. He had predicted that the relative share of wages in the national income would decline and the economic condition of the workers would deteriorate. But this has not happened. Empirical research has shown that in the countries in the pre-capitalist stage, labor's share in the national income has remained constant, and as Marx has said, there has been no decline in this share either. Page number 857. Empirical research has shown that in the countries in the pre-capitalist stage, labor's share in the national income has remained constant, and as Marx had said, there has been no decline in this share either. In the capitalist countries, labor has got sufficient share in the increase in physical productivity, which has taken place on account of technical progress and capital accumulation. As a result, there has been marked improvement in the living conditions of workers. That is why they are now less revolutionary than before. Besides, there is no evidence of decline in the rate of profit. It is in view of the declining rate of profit and concentration of purchasing power in the hands of a few people that Marx had predicted that capitalism would face crises off and on, and capitalism would ultimately come to an end. The actual events have falsified the gloomy predictions of Karl Marx. It is true that trade cycles keep recurring in the capitalistic economies. But in spite of short-term ups and downs, the capitalistic economies made a very rapid economic progress in the first 100 years, and it is on account of this that these countries became affluent. Professor Patterson has rightly remarked that Karl Marx had thought that capitalism would rapidly disintegrate on account of recurring serious crises, and it would finally and completely end on account of revolution by labor, and communism would be assured in this way. Marx had not only wrongly predicted about the behavior of labor's share in national income, but also about the long-term development of capitalism. Moreover, there are several theoretical flaws in the Marxian theory of declining rate of profit as a result of a change in organic composition of capital. Some writers have said that the law of declining rate of profit cannot be derived from the law of increasing organic composition of capital. Since Marx assumed that the real wages of labor remained stable at the subsistence level, there will be great increase in per capita productivity as a result of increase in the organic composition of capital owing to capital accumulation and technical progress. The rate of profit will also increase on account of real wages remaining constant at the subsistence level and rapid increase in the surplus value earned by the capitalists. It is worth noting Professor Kaldor's views on this connection. He says, since Marx assumed that the supply of price of labor remains unchanged in terms of commodities, when the organic composition of capital and hence output per head rises, there is no more reason to assume that an increase in organic composition will yield a lower rate of profit than a higher rate. For even if output per man were assumed to increase more slowly than constant plus variable capital per man, the surplus value per man or the excess of output per man over the cost of reproduction of labor will necessarily increase faster than output per man and may thus secure a rising rate of profit even if there is diminishing productivity to successive additions to fixed capital per unit of labor. Finally, Marx's theory of income distribution is based on the labor theory of value, which is not accepted by modern economists. Marxian analysis of surplus value or the exploitation of labor is obviously based on the concept that aggregate value is produced by labor and capital only transfers its value to the value of the commodity. Capital makes a significant contribution to productivity and substantially adds value. To deny this is only to show one's bias. Besides, the labor theory of value is only a form of the cost of production theory. As Marshall had said long time back, only costs of production or cost of labor together with cost of capital do not determine value. Price of a commodity also depends on its marginal utility of demand for it. The price of a commodity is determined by the interaction of the forces of demand and supply. Hence, Marx's view that the value of commodity is determined by that labor time which has been used in making it is wrong, and the modern economists do not accept it. Thus, if the labor theory of value is wrong, the theory of surplus value or theory of exploitation based on it is also proved to be wrong. Thus, if the labor theory of value is wrong, the theory of surplus value or theory of exploitation based on it is also proved to be wrong. Some other forms of socialism. Collectivism or state socialism. The collectivists or the state socialists believe in parliamentary democracy and nationalization of the means of production. They want to capture the political machinery, strengthen it, and use it for the realization of the socialist aims and ideas and ideals. The powerful state engine is to be utilized for the production of wealth and its equitable distribution. State is to be all in all, and as soon as the socialists have captured it, they have reached the goal. The state will do for them all that they want. Private enterprise will put an end to. Page number 858. All production will be carried on by salaried state officials, and profits will go to the state coffers and utilized for the uplift of the masses. The only difference between capitalism and state socialism is that under the latter, means of production are owned and managed by the state instead of the private entrepreneur. Otherwise, the exchange mechanism of capitalism, example, pricing, marketing, etc., is retained. Among the chief tenets of the socialist creed may be mentioned: A. State ownership of productive resources. B. Redistribution of national income. C. Economic planning. And D. Peaceful and democratic evolution of the economic system. Guild socialism. The guild socialists have no faith in the state running economic activity. Unlike the collectivists, the guild socialists do not believe that the state can successfully use the productive resources of the community. According to the guild socialists, it is necessary to do away with the private capitalists. But they want the business organizations, factories and productive resources, etc., to be handed over to the labor organization for management and operation. In their view, guilds of the workers can best run them. They want to put industries under the administration and control all these guilds. They want the state merely to supervise, fix prices and look after the quality of the products and thus safeguard the interests of the consumers. The basic principle is that the means of production should be under the ownership of the state, but the actual implementation of this ownership should be in the hands of the workers. The state should only see that the consumers are not exploited or cheated. The aim of the guild socialists is to avoid the evils of excessive concentration of power and inefficiency of bureaucracy in running the economic activities. They claim that according to their system, decentralization will usher in a real democracy. They claim that according to their system, decentralization will usher in real democracy in the world and improve the working capacity of industries. Page number 859. Syndicalism. The syndicalists too, like guild socialists, do not consider political power as an appropriate weapon for the achievement of socialist aims. Whatever the type of political authority, it invariably has a special type of bureaucratic tendency. It can never understand the aspirations of the workers. It has a bad habit of dominating over others. Hence, according to the views of the syndicalists, if the state is made all-powerful, it will produce many petty tyrants. That is why the syndicalists want to build up social, political and economic structure on the foundation of trade unions. They have no faith that they can achieve their aims through constitutional means. They know that political authorities are very powerful. Hence they, that is the syndicalists, believe in direct and violent action. Strike is their main weapon. They believe that even if the strike is unsuccessful, it gives the workers an experience in economic warfare. Through strikes, the workers become more strongly organized and their hatred for the capitalists becomes more bitter because of this. Through strikes, the workers become more strongly organized and their hatred for the capitalists becomes more bitter, and this hatred should not be allowed to diminish. Their strategy is that there should be strike after strike and a long strike in the end to paralyze the administration and capture power. The syndicalists lay great stress on the destruction of existing economic and political structure. They deliberately do not throw any light on the structure of society which they propose to create after the revolution. Their policy is that of destruction rather than construction. Communism. The Communist Manifesto of 1845 lays down the strategy that the communists want to adopt for the achievement of their aims. The communists lay stress on the formation of a network of communist organizations all over the country and the world. Capturing key posts in these organizations and carry on their work silently, adding to the number of adherents. When the party has become sufficiently strong, it attempts to capture government machinery and lay the foundation of a proletariat state. The state machinery is utilized to crush all opposition and to expropriate the capitalists. The aim is to create a classless society where there is no distinction of high or low, rich or poor. When the objective is satisfied, the state is considered unnecessary. It will wither away. As for the type of society which the communists envisage, some idea can be gathered from Plato's Republic or Wells' New Worlds for Old. The communists propose to abolish all forms of private property, not merely in the instruments of production, but also in the consumers' goods. These consumers' goods, which are intimately connected with the person of the consumer, example through food and clothing, are transferred to individuals and families, and those which are not so connected, example houses, are owned by society. Only their services are transferred to the consumers. People are supposed to work according to capacity and get according to need. Everybody is to be assigned a definite job. He cannot choose his own occupation. Nobody will have a house of his own or a bank account. Everyone will have to be a government employee. He will not be paid cash, but he will get his meals in the state kitchen and live in government quarters. He will be provided commodities and services for consumption, not of his choice, but what the state chose to give according to production is the time. The bringing up of the children, their education and employment will be the state concern. The pricing system will disappear. The state will control production, assign jobs, fix remuneration and prices of goods and services without profit motive. A very alluring dream indeed. It is utopian. In the communist society, there will be no trade cycles or unemployment, nor can there be differences of the rich and the poor. The conflict between labor and capital will disappear. This view is undoubtedly imaginary and impractical. In the beginning, the Russians tried to implement these ideas. They abolished money in exchange, but it did not work. The money economy had to be re-established. In order to provide incentives for efficiency and good work, different wages had to be offered. Anarchism. The ultimate aim of the communists is to build a social structure in which there will be no need for the state. As we said above, the state will wither away. This is technically known as anarchy. In ordinary language, anarchy means absence of government rule and disorder. But in the socialist phraseology, it simply means statelessness. When the administration has become superfluous and the society regulates itself out, there is no disorder. The communists believe that when capitalism has come to an end, all greed, selfishness, cheating, tyranny, etc., generally associated with capitalism, will disappear from the world, and in their place will be established virtues of self-sacrifice, social service, goodwill, etc. Instead of grabbing, the people will adopt an attitude of sacrificing for others. Man will have been so much uplifted, then there will be no need for the police. The courts will be closed. Is it surprising? Farhian tells about the ancient Indian society that there were no thefts and no robberies, and people did not lock their houses. It is possible that sometimes the anarchist dream may come true. The economic and social life will be organized into self-regulating or self-governing institutions. Page number 860. The economic and social life will be organized into self-regulating or self-governing institutions. All the functions of the state will be automatically carried out. Every individual will respect the rights of others, and there will be no difficulty of any type. The state will be like an automatic traffic signal. When the policeman is off the traffic duty, the traffic regulates itself. This is how the society will itself regulate its affairs in the absence of a government. This is another sweet dream. We get an outline of this plan from Prince Kropotkin. The anarchists say that the government is needed only to protect the unjustly obtained wealth, undue profits, and loot of the capitalists. When capitalism goes, the government will follow suit. Fabian Socialists. Fabian Socialists are men of literature. Bernard Shaw was one of them. They sincerely believe that socialism is a question of conviction. If the people can only be convinced of the virtues of socialism, no power on earth can prevent its coming about. Through literary propaganda, novels, dramas, short stories, they expose the evils of capitalism and bring out the merits and necessity of socialism. It is hoped that in the course of time the world will come to believe in socialism, and socialism will then come to prevail. This may not be wrong. They may not be wrong. General features of socialism. Although there is a great diversity of views among the socialists, and there are as many types of socialism as well as there are socialists, yet it is possible to pick up a few general features of socialism. 1. Social ownership of means of production. The socialists believe in the abolition of private ownership in the instruments of production. Land, factories, railways, mines, and every other means of production must be nationalized. Their ownership and control are to be vested in the state so that the state may provide work for everybody. Socialization of the means of production is so important a characteristic feature of socialism that some writers define socialism as social ownership of the means of production. The means of production are the property of the state and not of private individuals. The profits of all enterprises go to the state exchequer to be utilized for the benefit of society rather than for the benefit of a few private individuals. But it may be mentioned that it is not necessary to nationalize all means of production to bring about socialism. Generally, it is considered sufficient and useful to nationalize only the principal means of production, like heavy and basic industries, mines, banks, means of transport like railways, motor transport, etc. However, state control extends over all means of production and the entire economy to make sure that the economy functions to promote the interests of the society as a whole. So far as land is concerned, the actual tiller or a cooperative society can be given the ownership. In fact, land to the tiller is the principal objective of socialism. Several other land reforms are introduced so that the tiller is actually made the owner of the land and he gets a proper reward for his labor. Besides, the farmers are encouraged to form cooperative farming societies so that large-scale farming can be undertaken. 2. No private enterprise. Generally, there is to be no private enterprise. Production is to be initiated and conducted by the state, which will pay wages and other costs and keep profits to itself. Interest and rent as payments respectively to the capitalists and the landlords will disappear, for the state will be the capitalist, landlord and entrepreneur. However, in agriculture, as mentioned above, cooperatives may be permitted. 3. Economic equality. Living on unearned income is to be discouraged. Remuneration for work is to be according to the nature of work and is not to be equal. Earnings will vary according to ability. A limited operation of the law of demand and supply in this connection is envisaged. There is thus no basis for the belief that under socialism all would be equal economically. No economic equality is guaranteed. But there are to be no glaring inequalities. All possible steps are taken to reduce economic inequalities of income and wealth. Since industrial and business employees belong to the state, there is little possibility of amassing wealth by private individuals. In other words, perfect economic equality is not the aim of socialism. However, it aims at social justice in the distribution of national income. It is therefore aims at giving a fair share to all in the national income. Page number 861. Some inequality in incomes is considered essential to provide incentive for harder and better work. Unless efficient workers are paid better, no one will try to be efficient in his work. Hence, workers will not fully use their skill, ability and experience unless they are better rewarded. Thus, in the case of perfect equality of income, national output will go down and the nation is bound to suffer. The national economy will suffer in performance if income inequality is insisted upon. The national economy will suffer in performance if income equality is insisted upon. Thus, instead of perfect equality of incomes, the socialists aim at minimum practicable inequality. As Douglas J. observes, basic aim of socialism is not literal or absolute equality, but the minimum equality that is workable if human beings are actively to use their talents, not equal share but fair shares, not perfect equality but social justice. Systems of inheritance which leads to unearned incomes is not permitted. Those factors of production, example land, capital, which can yield unearned incomes are nationalized. But interest on savings given to the government is permissible. 4. Equality of opportunity. Although, as we have said above, socialism does not guarantee perfect equality of income, it aims at providing equality of opportunity. In fact, to provide equality of opportunity is a basic objective of socialism. Every individual, whether he belongs to a rich family or a poor family, has an equal opportunity to rise in life under socialism. Every young person is given equal opportunity to receive education or training according to his aptitude so that he can enter a profession of his choice. Children of poor parents have to face lots of difficulties in life. The poor parents are not in a position to provide their children basic minimum means to equip themselves mentally or physically for life. They have no resources at their disposal to give the necessary education and training. Either they cannot afford to send their children to school, or they have to withdraw them from the school early to supplement their income by putting them to a job. The inequality of opportunity starts from the birth itself. The atmosphere in which these children are brought up is suffocating and causes them intense worry. The socialist society does not tolerate it. Under socialism, such steps are taken that every child, whatever his family background, gets full opportunity to develop his inborn and latent faculties. To ensure equal opportunities for all, it is essential to provide free education and health services up to the secondary standard. At the university level also, it is essential to provide talented students a scheme of stipends and freeships. All these things are provided under a socialist regime. 5. Economic planning. The state is in charge of both production and distribution. The allocation of the productive resources of the community will be determined according to the direction of a central authority. In fact, economic planning is an essential feature of socialism. Economic planning is most closely associated with the Russian system. Although now for some years economic planning has been adopted by capitalist countries too, yet it cannot be comprehensive and effective as under socialism. Because under capitalism the means of production are under the control of private individuals and the direction of production and of productive resources is done through price mechanism. There can be only indicative planning or planning by inducement under capitalism which does not prove to be effective. Since under socialism the principal means of production are owned and controlled by the state, it is possible to direct the production of commodities and the utilization of resources in the desired channels. If it is so desired to use the productive resources effectively and to protect a certain set of commodities, economic planning is essential for socialism. Under socialism, the phase of price mechanism is taken by planting. Under socialism, the place of price mechanism is taken by planning commission, which is entrusted with the work of laying down the objectives of planning and to settle the targets and priorities of planning. The Planning Commission formulates 5-year plans for economic development which are implemented through the various governmental agencies. Economic planning ensures speedy economic development. It ensures efficient and optimum allocation of resources. In the underdeveloped countries, where without raising the level of national income and wealth, socialism cannot be brought about, economic planning is absolutely essential for socialism because without it, the level of production cannot be raised. But under socialism, only increase in production is not considered sufficient. The objectives of socialism is also to ensure a fair distribution of gains in production and income. Hence, economic planning is required for socialism not merely to accelerate economic development but also to ensure a fair distribution of fruits and commerce. But under socialism, only increase in production is not considered sufficient. The objectives of socialism is also to ensure a fair distribution of gains in production and income. Hence, economic planning is required for socialism not merely to accelerate economic development but also to ensure a fair distribution of fruits of economic growth. Page number 862. In pursuance of the socialist objectives, economic planning in India is not only to raise the level of national income but also to reduce economic inequalities and to prevent concentration of economic power. 6. Social welfare and social security. Another important feature of socialism is that it is a social welfare consideration which guides productive activity in the economy rather than private profit. Under capitalism, only production of such commodities and services is undertaken which are expected to yield maximum profit. It follows therefore that under capitalism, luxury goods are produced for the rich rather than goods of mass consumption required by the poor. The poor are thus deprived of the necessaries of life, while the rich are enabled to lead a luxurious and wasteful life. This is so because production of luxuries is more profitable than the production of necessaries of life. In this way, profit motive is the determining factor of economic activity under capitalism. But the situation is entirely different under socialism. Commodities and services of such type and in such quantities are produced which are essential for promoting social welfare. The motive power of economic activity under socialism is social welfare and not private profit. The work which is performed by market mechanism under capitalism is performed by central economic authority under socialism, which determines and guides all economic activity. Planning Commission keeps social welfare uppermost in consideration. Under socialism, the state devotes its attention to ameliorating the lot of the common man by providing him and his family with adequate medical aid, full and free education, and ample means of recreation and entertainment. Freedom from want is guaranteed, and fear born of insecurity is to be banned. 7. Classless society. The socialists believe in a classless society where the distinction between the rich and the poor and the haves and the have-nots has completely disappeared. Thus, the caste system that prevails in India is repugnant to socialists. In a socialist state, every individual enjoys equality of opportunity regardless of caste, creed, family, and religion. A socialist state is really a secular state. The prime objective of a socialist state is that the society is not divided into two classes of labor and capitalists as under capitalism. That is why big zamindars and capitalists have no place under socialism. Severe restrictions are imposed on the control and ownership of private wealth. Every individual gets a reward according to his work and ability. It is in this way that class conflict which prevails under capitalism is put an end to under socialism, and a classless society is created. Case for socialism. The evils of capitalism have given birth to socialism. Socialism has started as a reaction to industrial revolution that took place in the Western European countries. The industrial revolution of the Western European countries made some people very rich in the midst of poverty elsewhere. It resulted in the exploitation of labor, women, and children by the capitalists. Above all, capitalism failed to maintain economic stability. Periodically, the capitalist economy is engulfed in depression, which is responsible for large-scale unemployment of and hardship to millions of people. Also, capitalism has given rise to extreme inequalities of income and wealth. The poor were deprived of social justice. Owing to the domination of the individual profit motive, the capitalist economy witnessed a serious misallocation of resources. Socialism seeks to rectify all these evils and create a just social order. Socialists claim the following merits for their system. 1. Social justice. The chief merit of socialism is that it assures of social justice. Under socialism, the inequalities of income are reduced to the minimum and the national income is more equitably and evenly distributed. The socialist principle provides for a fair share for all. No one is permitted to have unearned income. Exploitation of man by man is put an end to. Every individual is assured of equal opportunity to develop his latent faculties through proper education and training. 2. Better allocation of resources. As compared with capitalism, the productive resources of the national are more economically and optimally allocated among the various productive uses. Owing to extreme inequalities of income and the existence of monopolies in the industrial sector, capitalism is incapable of a rational and economical allocation of the productive resources of the community. Page number 863. Besides, private entrepreneurs do not take into consideration social costs while deciding about the allocation of resources. As a result, the productive resources of the community are misallocated. On the contrary, under socialism, a central planning authority determines the allocation of resources among the various uses whose sole aim is to promote social welfare and social security. A planning authority is in a better position to assess the basic needs of the people and the intensity of their desires and to devote the resources to satisfy these desires and meet these needs in the best possible manner. It is wrong to say that socialism completely ignores consumers' preferences and demand for the various commodities and services. In a socialist economy, state can fix the prices of finished goods and give to the consumers a free choice of the goods available in the market at fixed prices. The consumer's demand and preferences can be estimated from the purchases made by them in the market, and resources can be devoted to the production of commodities accordingly. But there is no harm also in ignoring certain desires of the consumers if they conflict with social welfare. Often, a consumer is unable to understand what is best for him. Hence, the Planning Commission under socialism has to strike a desirable balance between social welfare considerations and the individual consumer's preferences. Thus, the allocation of resources under socialism proves to be much better and more rational. In the allocation of resources, due consideration is given to human wants, consumers' preferences, and social costs. 3. Improving productive efficiency. Another important merit of socialism is that under it, national output can be significantly increased. This is due to the fact that under socialism, the production is undertaken to increase social welfare and not for the benefit of any particular individual. Under socialism, improved techniques of production and scientific research are made freely available to all organizations that may need them. On the other hand, under capitalism, improved production techniques and results of scientific research, which are known to certain firms, are generally kept absolutely secret so that the competing firms cannot avail themselves of them. And what is more, the monopoly concerns under capitalism limit their output so that they may raise the prices of their products in order to increase their monopoly profits. This means that their output is below the welfare level. But this cannot happen under socialism because none can benefit from the policy of reducing output. All major industries are under complete social control and they are run for social benefit. It is quite clear that the society cannot benefit by reducing output, for the reduction of output means reduction of national income and so of social welfare. Under socialism, production techniques are also improved because it avoids all ways of competition. In a capitalist economy, large quantity of financial resources are wasted in competitive advertisement. Different entrepreneurs compete against one another to attract consumers or purchasers of goods. Besides, resources are wasted in the production of unnecessarily large variety of goods. Page number 864. Since under socialism, the state controls production, there is no need to waste resources on competitive advertisement. However, under socialism, some expenditure is incurred on information and educative program which is not wasteful. Also, under socialism, concentrating production in big firms results in improvement of production techniques. Moreover, there is no idle capacity kept under socialism, as is usually the case under capitalism. A socialist state makes the fullest use of productive activity. 4. Social security and welfare. Socialism provides social security for all citizens. The socialists believe that people should be given protection against uncertainties relating to income, work, and living conditions, and the burden of this provision should be borne by the entire society. That is why modern socialists include in their program schemes of social insurance covering unemployment, accidents, sickness, old age pensions, death grants, etc. In fact, an individual is provided security from cradle to the grave. Most of the things which are considered essential for the individual's health and training are provided by the socialist state, either free or at the cost of production. A socialist state can provide free of cost milk for children, nursing, education and medical aid. A socialist state is truly a welfare state. 5. Economic stability. There is another advantage of socialism, that is, it ensures economic stability. Socialism eliminates trade cycles which cause a great hardship to the people. We do not come across depression, unemployment, and idle productive capacity in socialist economies. In the capitalist countries, absence of effective demand causes cyclical unemployment and business depression. This absence of monetary effective demand is due to the excess of people's savings over investment expenditure. But since under socialism, the means of production are owned and controlled by the state, the level of investment and the level of aggregate demand can also be effectively determined. This ensures economic stability. Sometimes in socialist economies too, there can be an imbalance between aggregate demand and aggregate supply, but it can be effectively tackled. A socialist state can prevent the imbalance between aggregate demand and aggregate supply from creating trade cycles in the economy and thus makes for economic stability. Demerits of socialism. The critics of socialism claim to have picked numerous holes in the socialist fabric. Apart from some silly objections which have been exploded since long, example, socialism would ban religion, abolish marriage and family life, and the dangling of Malthusian bogey to frighten the simple and ignorant minds, earnest efforts have been made to understand socialism and point out some real dangers and difficulties. 1. Bureaucracy and red tapism. The most important set of arguments advanced against socialism is one against the bureaucratic running of the economic machinery. Bureaucracy is considered to be inefficient in running a business. The civil servant does not feel the same keen self-interest as the employee of a private corporation where his tenure is not so secure. The civil servant knows that he will get promotion by seniority. No amount of alertness or extra work is going to push him up in the graded list. His main concern is to let things go on somehow without a positive breakdown. One thing that he wants to avoid is public criticism. He will therefore take no bold risks and will be content with a moderate measure of success being merely guided by rule and precedent. Initiative and resourcefulness are at a discount. The business policy will be timid and unenterprising. There is routine and red tape, a place safe for men of mediocre caliber, and no room for extraordinary and dashing spirits. No first-rate work can be done by second-rate men. Bureaucracy will further mean bossism, loss of individual liberty, Gestapo, etc. 2. Not successful in business. A government department cannot claim to score success in business where quick decisions have to be taken and bold policies are called for. The government personnel is not such as can conquer new fields. The government can and does attract able men, but conditions in government service are not congenial for the display of extraordinary ability. The reward is not considered worth the trouble. 3. Insufficient resources. It is also urged that government cannot raise the huge amounts of capital which are necessary for the efficient running and expanding of all industries and trades. 4. Misallocation of resources. Under socialism, there will be no automatic indicator for the most economical allocation of the resources of the community among different industries. Under capitalism, there are consumers' preferences which, through price mechanism, bring about an optimum allocation of these resources. But under socialism, it will be all groping in the dark. Some commodities will be produced in excess and wasted, whereas there may be a shortage of others, resulting in unsatisfied demand. A chronic maladjustment in demand and supply is feared. The task of organizing production, of allocating every acre of land to its proper use, of setting every worker on the right job, and of investing every rupee in the direction of maximum benefit is too big to be performed by any single authority. Page number 865. 5. Loss of consumers' sovereignty. Under capitalism, the consumer enjoys sovereignty. Of course, this sovereignty is limited by his income, existence of monopoly, etc. Yet, the domain is wide enough for him to pick and choose. But under socialism, he will lose this sovereignty altogether. Consumption will have to adjust itself to production. This loss to the consumer is a real loss. He will not be able to maximize his satisfaction. The state will no doubt fix the prices, but it will be all arbitrary. The price fixation will be rigid and will lack the resiliency of market mechanism, which is sensitive to even the slightest change in the consumer's preferences. 6. Lack of incentives. It is also feared that incentive to hard work and stimulus to self-improvement will disappear altogether when personal gain or self-interest is eliminated. People will not give their best. Inventive ability, enterprising spirit, and the go-ahead attitude will languish, and creative work will become impossible. It is remarked that a government could print a good edition of Shakespeare's works, but it could not get them written.
Reference note: Pigou, Capitalism and Socialism, page 80.
7. Loss of economic freedom. There will be loss of economic freedom under socialism. A serious charge against socialism is that when freedom of enterprise disappears, even the free choice of occupation will go. Workers will be assigned certain jobs and they cannot change them without the consent of the planning authority. Every worker is dovetailed in the scheme and he must remain there. This loss of freedom may be really galling. 8. No economic equality. Some people have been disappointed in socialism because in Russia, where it has been in operation, it has failed to bring about economic equality. The difference between the rich and the poor is still there. The dream of a classless society is far from being realized. The workers under capitalism, example in the USA and the UK, are not so worse off. They enjoy a high standard of living. They are not convinced that under capitalism the poor go on becoming poorer. The rich are no doubt getting richer, but the lot of the poor is also undoubtedly improving. It is thus that some degree of skepticism in the efficacy of socialism as a panacea for all social ills has grown and damped the ardor of some enthusiastic socialists. 9. Concentration of power in the state. The greatest danger of socialism is that too much power is concentrated in the state. Under socialism, the state is not merely a political authority, but it also exercises unlimited authority in the economic sphere. To the extent all power is concentrated in the state, the danger is that the state is everything and individual nothing. He may not count at all. He is reduced to a cipher. After all, the human institutions are for man and not man for these institutions. 10. Loss of personal liberty. That under socialism there is no unemployment is conceded, but the critics retort by saying that there is also no unemployment in a jail. They regret a socialist state as one big prison house, and they do not think that employment is any compensation for the loss of liberty. 11. Not scientific. It may also be pointed out in the end that Marxian socialism is not so scientific after all. Labor is not the only source of value and is not the sole right to its appropriation. Few are convinced of the accuracy of Marx's materialistic interpretation of history. Economic motives are no doubt the strongest, but they are not the only ones to sway human actions. Criticism answered. This looks a formidable array of arguments against socialism, but it is not so formidable as it may seem. The strength of socialism lies in the proved evils of capitalism. The world is periodically plunged into depression, causing much dislocation, unemployment, and suffering. Capitalism has not been able to ensure stable economic conditions. National resources have been exploited for personal profit. Human beings, especially women and children, have been used as so many machines simply to enrich the capitalists. Who can help hearing the cry of the children? How long, O cruel nation, will you stand to move the world on a child's heart? Stifle down with a mailed heel its palpitation, and tread onward to your throne amid the mart. Our blood splashes upward, O gold heaper, and your purple shows your path. This poem is by Elizabeth Barrett Browning. The social conscience feels outraged at the sight of a poor family working with the hardest, yet not getting 2 square meals a day, dressed in rags, living in dirty cells, and children dying because they cannot get medical aid or milk. On the other hand, the rich are rolling in luxuries. Their horses and dogs are better fed and housed than their fellow human beings. Page number 866. They perhaps think that the poor man is not, after all, a human being. He is some other species. A system which produces such iniquities and callousness stands self-condemned. Look at the alternative. Socialism bans trade depression and removes unemployment, which under capitalism always hangs over the worker's head like a Damocles sword. A great worry is off. Free choice of occupation under capitalism is a farce. Who can really choose his occupation? The choice is limited by his parents' means and influence. Sometimes a man would like to get any work that he can, but there is no work. Capitalism throws him on the scrap heap. Who would not like to be put on to a job compulsorily rather than face enforced unemployment and starvation? A socialist state provides permanent and pensionable job for everybody according to his aptitude and capacity. A socialist state can allocate the resources of the community among the various uses with the sole consideration of social security and welfare. Consumers' wishes have to be replaced by higher social valuations. It is possible that at one stage there may be a shortage of some type of consumers' goods, but this is deliberately done in the higher interests of the society. Surely there is no harm in making a temporary sacrifice so that we or our children may be able to enjoy better standards later. Only a socialist state can build up a solid foundation for the country's strength and prosperity. The policy of a capitalist economy is a short-sighted one, guided by the immediate gains of the entrepreneur. Under socialism, vast funds can be devoted to the expansion of education of all types, for provision of adequate medical facilities, and for relationalization of industry and reorganization of agriculture. The result is that human and material resources of the nation are immensely improved and fully utilized. A socialist state can easily find resources to help the poor because the profits of industry, which under capitalism go to enrich the already rich and surfeited, are pooled in the state treasury. Many things, the consumption of which is considered essential for health and efficiency, may be supplied free or below cost. No doubt, consumption is regimented and it is curtailed in certain directions, yet be no hardship, for it may be expanded in some other and more desirable directions. A socialist state can provide free milk for children, free nursing, free education, and free medical aid. It can give free cinema shows to the workers and provide for them swimming pools, recreational clubs, railway passes to weekend resorts, and light refreshment in the factory gratis. Such things are impossible in a capitalist economy where the lure of the lure rules. A capitalist only looks to his dividend. Production of all types can be immediately increased by a socialist state. The achievements of the Russian five-year plans are a standing monument to what can be achieved under socialism by people who not long ago were illiterate, ignorant, backward, conservative, and poor peasants. Russia, too, like India, was a country of small farmers, almost all illiterate. Now, there is nearly 100% literacy, and in production, Russia has beaten every other European country which started in the race for industrialization nearly one century ago. This shows that it is only in a socialist state that planning can really be effective. This is all due to the fact that all phases of economic life are under the central state direction. Dangers of bureaucratic management have been exaggerated. There is a lot of red tapeism in company management even under capitalism. A socialist state can also regulate credit and banking operations so that financial maladjustments are eliminated. As for incentive to hard work, a socialist state can, by persistent propaganda and through instruction in the educational institutions, change the very psychology of the people and create new scales of values. It can offer production bonuses so that every worker does his best. Who will do the dirty work? The socialist answer is that most of it will be done by the machinery. Machinery is not being put to such tasks to present simply because man is cheaper than machinery. Thousands of semi-starving people are available under capitalism to do such jobs on small wages because capitalism has impoverished the masses. Page number 867. But a socialist state not working for profit will be in a position to relieve man from all dangerous, dirty, and degrading jobs. Socialism may not be able to make everybody economically equal. This is due not to the lack of organizing ability in a socialist state. The cause lies in the innate inequalities among human beings. Nature does not make everyone alike. Everyone is endowed with varying degrees of intelligence and working capacity. No state can help it. It is not a matter for legislation. But a socialist state can discover the aptitude and ability of each citizen and develop them further by training and education so that every citizen is enabled to make his best contribution to the welfare of the state. Real worth will not be allowed to be suppressed or depressed by poverty. The socialist state can pick up genius even from the lowliest of families and provide it with the fullest facilities and opportunities. If, therefore, the attainment of economic equality is not considered feasible, at least equality of opportunity can be assured to each, and this will be no mean achievement. There can also be a considerable leveling up of the masses. The balance seems to be heavily tilted in favor of socialism. Some problems of socialism. It will be of interest to know how Soviet Russia has tackled the various economic problems. Private property. Private property in the form of a house, a car, a few animals and other consumers' goods is allowed. A man is free to buy government bonds or securities. He can keep a deposit in the bank. Property up to the amount of 50,000 rubles can be transmitted by inheritance. But living on unearned income is discouraged, and all unearned income is subject to very heavy taxation. Only bourgeois property, which is the result of exploitation, is sought to be abolished. Pricing system. Under the free enterprise, competitive and individualistic system, the pricing system automatically solves the major economic problems. Some economists, however, notably Mrs. Hayek and Robbins, are of the opinion that rational accounting is impossible under a socialist regime and that it is all groping in the dark. But there are other economists like Pigou who do not see any difficulty in this. Dickinson and some other economists are of the opinion that the capitalist apparatus of marketing and pricing can be retained in socialism. Russians have been able to fix prices of the goods. Costs of raw materials and wages, transport and all other costs are added, and then a small percentage for a little profit. This gives a selling price. It is a little arbitrary. The prices do not reflect the intensities of consumers' demands, although some note is taken of the relative scarcities. But in a socialist society, prices of goods will be low enough to clear the available supplies and also high enough to cover the socially necessary marginal costs of production. The price under socialist planning need not be market price as under capitalism. It is purely a bookkeeping or accounting price set by the planning authority. In recent years, however, the crude quantitative goods in the physical units are being replaced by profitability criteria of performance. By this process of economic valuation, socialism seems to be moving in the direction of capitalism. Supply of labor and wages. There is no freedom of choice of occupation. There are also ample facilities for technical training. The government is prepared to bear the cost of training on the condition that the trainees, after completing training, work in government factories for a term of years on conditions settled beforehand. Money wages are paid, and there are variations according to ability, efficiency, and the nature of work. Standard wages are fixed after a thorough motion study and time study in order to ascertain the standard time required for a job. Efficiency premia are paid to better workers who take less time. Wages are also supplemented by the payment to the workers of a lump sum social dividend payment. This payment varies with the size, composition and health status of the family. By means of such payments, inequalities of income are mitigated. If there is a comparative shortage of some type of labor, higher wages are of course offered to attract the right type and sufficient supply of labor. Page number 868. Workers are assigned definite jobs. The workers could also be transferred from one place to another, just like government servants. The government tries to adjust supply to demand. Wages. The system of setting accounting prices on labor, as in the case of other productive resources, will not do, for the amount of labor is not a fixed quantity. People can choose their occupation, and they can also choose whether to work more or work less, that is, whether to prefer income or leisure. Hence, it is essential to have a system of actual market wages rather than accounting wages. These rates will vary according to the agreeableness or disagreeableness of the job, possibility of supplementary earning, training or skill required to do a job, productivity of individual workers, etc. Marginal productivity will determine the wage. Thus, there will be no dead level of wages in a socialist state. The wages will depend on the valuation that society places on the needs and worth of individual workers and the necessity for compensation to those who have to do dirty, irksome and arduous jobs. Inequality of incomes will no longer be accounted for by inequalities of property, but by such factors as mentioned above. Finance. The Russians have repudiated foreign debts and could not hope to secure foreign loans. They relied therefore mostly on created money. Paper money was issued by the state in enormous amounts. There was inflation with all the usual consequences, exorbitant prices, and a very high cost of living, etc. They also raised loans from the public, from the people. Later on, income from socialized industry flowed in and helped to finance the later stages of planning. Rent. Even a socialist state cannot do away with the concept of rent. Change of economic order from capitalism to socialism will not turn scarce land into an unlimited quantity. Rent as an index of productivity will help in the best allocation of the available land among its various types of land, the good land being put a higher tag. As Samuelson puts it, only by putting a price upon inert, sweatless land are we using it and sweating, breathing labor more productively. The price or rent of land rises so as to ration its limited supply among the best uses. Even a socialist state will have to direct land from one use to another so as to make its marginal productivity in all uses. Even a socialist state will have to direct land from one use to another so as to make its marginal productivity in all uses the same. This marginal productivity will be indicated by rent. This is the only way to ensure a correct allocation of valuable human or material resources. Interest. The Russians have not abolished interest altogether. The government itself pays interest on state loans. Interest shows an attempt to bring the demand for and supply of capital into equilibrium. The banks also pay interest on personal accounts. Interest as remuneration to the capitalist, that is, payment to private owners of idle money, does not occupy an important place in Russian economy, since private capital has practically disappeared. The state borrows and pays interest and appropriates the profit of industry. What role does interest play in a socialist state? In a capitalist state, we know that interest performs three important functions. A. It determines people's income from bonds and other assets. B. It is necessary payment to induce people to part with liquidity. And C. It relates future and present economic values, that is, it helps society to decide how much of the national income should be invested in capital formation and where should the capital be used. Now, the first two functions have no bearing in a socialist state. Since capital is no longer the property of private individuals, interest as an income determining factor or as an inducement for disholding does not exist. But whatever the form of economy, interest must continue to perform the third function, that is, to determine the allocation of the economic resources of the community as between present and future, and the allocation of capital among different uses in the present. The rate of interest acts like a sieve or a rationing device. Capital is scarce and the uses for which it is wanted are unlimited. The rate of interest is the indicator of the directions in which capital should move. Obviously, enterprises with a prospective yield at 12% are to be undertaken in preference to those yielding 10%. Page number 869. The rate of interest must be used to allocate scarce capital supplies optimally and to determine the order of priority of alternative projects. Allocation of factors of production. The state planning authority tries to estimate the amounts of factors required for the targeted production in an industry and arranges for the supply. It is first decided which industries have to be developed and to what extent. The factors of production are diverted in channels set by the state and according to consumers' preferences. For example, the Russians concentrated first on heavy industries. Naturally, there was a shortage of consumers' goods whose prices shot up. In a capitalistic system, factors of production would rush towards consumers' goods industries. In a capitalistic system, factors of production would rush towards consumers' goods industries to make up for their deficiency. But a socialist state does not allow this diversion. Shortage would continue and rationing and price control introduced. In Russia, the normal functioning of the price mechanism, which brings about an optimum distribution of resources as judged by the consumers' valuations, is nullified by state action. Thus, the resources are allocated not according to the valuation of the consumers, but according to the valuation of the state. The state decides what is best for the nation at a particular period of its life and arranges the distribution of resources accordingly. The consumers must adjust their demands according to production and the exigencies of the state. Future of socialism after 1989. A number of countries opted for free enterprise economy after the 1989 demolition of the Berlin Wall. Today, socialism in its traditional form of authoritarian or market socialism rarely exists in the world. Only Vietnam or North Korea, Cuba, and certain small pockets in different parts of the world it exists, that too not a powerful one. It is only in a simplest form. Socialism, once a powerful economic system, was ruling the world during the second half of the 20th century. Socialism, in real sense, was a good economic system, though it had not given many economic freedom to people. The cause of collapse of socialism is not the system, but its application by the leaders. Socialism became one of the powerful weapons among the Russian leaders and other Warsaw Pact countries to exploit people for their own benefits. Socialism means welfare of society or mankind, but it was used for exploiting the mankind. Giving the people the bare necessities and the rest for the personal use of the leaders. There was no difference between the Tsars and Joseph Stalin. The Tsars built up huge war machines at the cost of the people, the same thing did by Stalin in a different or somewhat refined way. Marshal Tito, the former Yugoslavian president, was the only leader who declined to accept the hegemony of the Russians. This was regarding the planning and expansion of market program, which the Russians under Stalin were interested in carrying out over the Warsaw Pact countries. Tito said, "We are competent enough to carry out our internal economic planning for our country and denounce the interference of the Russians in their internal affairs." Pandit Jawaharlal Nehru was the first Prime Minister of India who appreciated the way Russians achieved economic development in a short period and based the economic ideology of India on socialistic pattern of society. Mrs. Gandhi, in real term, brought about certain bold decisions in the form of nationalization of commercial banks, abolishment of privy purses, and nationalization of some foreign corporate sectors and as government undertakings. The environment of capitalist economy all over the world engulfed the basic principle of socialism. Today, in India, the government, which at once used to take care of the common masses by providing jobs, social security measures, educational facilities, health and other measures, is backing out and handing it over to the private sector. Disinvestment policy, privatization of education, health, disinvestment policy, privatization of education, healthcare and other essential services are being reduced by the government from its functions. Generally, for any economy to get its fruits, it requires certain amount of time. Page number 870. The education, health, poverty alleviation programs which the government initiated sometime between 1970s and 1990s helped the economy to revive in the 21st century. Now the market socialism is no more in India and we are following completely the capitalist economy. There is a possibility of wider inequalities of income and wealth, and other problems may come, as that of the case of Latin American countries, and this may revive the beginning of socialism in its new form. History repeats, if exploitation of the common man increases, then it may sow the seeds of revolution and which may initiate the beginning of yet another form of socialism. Key terms: socialism, Marxian socialism, authoritarian socialism, liberal socialism, guild socialism, communism, syndicalism, surplus value, anarchism, Fabian socialism, economic planning. Questions. 1. Critically evaluate the future of socialism. 2. What are the main features of capitalism? Discuss its merits and demerits. 3. Compare the economic role of the state in a socialist economy with its role in a capitalist economy. 4. Distinguish between capitalism and socialism. In what respects is socialism superior to capitalism? 5. How does a capitalist society differ from a socialist one? To what extent are the defects of both eliminated in a mixed economy? 6. Examine critically the case for socialism as a system more conducive to the progress of society than capitalism. 7. What can be the incentives to production under a socialist economy? Can they be more effective than those under capitalism?